Tell me, is it possible that you are not offended at the thought that a man despised your love? That he did not wish, but he did not despise it. I believed that he loved me, but he was an obedient son. Yes, but if it had not been his mother's doing, but his own, said Kitty, feeling that she had given away her secret, and that her face, burning with a blush of shame, had already betrayed her. Then he would have behaved badly, and I should not regret him, replied Varenka, evidently conscious that they were now speaking not about her, but about Kitty. But the humiliation, said Kitty. One cannot forget the humiliation. One cannot. And she remembered the look she gave Vronsky at the ball when the music stopped. Where is the humiliation? You did not do anything wrong. Worse than wrong. Shameful. Varenka shook her head and put her hand on Kitty's. Shameful in what respect? She said. You could not have told a man who was himself indifferent to you that you loved him. Of course not. I never said a single word, but he knew it. No, no. There are such things as looks and ways of behaving. If I live to be 100, I shall never forget it. What does it matter? I don't understand. The question is, do you love him now or not? Said Varenka, calling everything by its plain name. I hate him, and I cannot forgive myself. But what does it matter? The shame, the humiliation. Dear me, if everyone were as sensitive as you, said Varenka. There is no girl who has not gone through the same sort of thing, and it is all so unimportant. Then what is important? Asked Kitty, looking into her face with surprised curiosity. Ah, many things are important, replied Varenka, not knowing what to say. But at that moment they heard the princess's voice from the window. Kitty, it is getting chilly. Either take a shawl or come in. Yes, I really must be going, said Varenka, rising. I have to look in at Madame Bertha's. She asked me to. Kitty held her hands, and with passionate curiosity and entreaty questioned Varenka with her eyes. What? What is more important? What gives you such peace? You know. Tell me. But Varenka did not even understand what Kitty's eyes were asking. She only knew that she had to call on Madame Bertha and get home in time for Mama's midnight tea. She went in, collected her music, and having said good night to everybody, prepared to go.
Allow me to see you home, said the colonel.
Yes, how can you go alone at this time of night? Agreed the princess. I will at any rate send Parasha with you. Kitty noticed that Varenka had difficulty in suppressing a smile at the idea that she needed anyone to see her home. Oh, no, I always go out alone, and nothing ever happens to me, she said, taking up her hat. And kissing Kitty again, but without telling her what was most important, she went out with vigorous steps with her music under her arm and disappeared in the semi-darkness of the summer night, carrying with her the secret of what was important and to what she owed her enviable tranquillity and dignity. Chapter 33 Kitty also became acquainted with Madame Stahl, and this acquaintanceship, together with Varenka's friendship, not only had a great influence on Kitty, but comforted her in her sorrow. What comforted her was that a perfectly new world was revealed to her, a world that had nothing in common with her past, an exalted, admirable world, from the heights of which it was possible to regard that past calmly. It was revealed to her that besides that instinctive life she had lived hitherto, there was also a spiritual life. That life was revealed by religion, but a religion that had nothing in common with that which Kitty had known since her childhood, and which found expression in Mass and Vespers at the private chapel of the Widow's Almshouse, where one could meet one's friends, and in learning Slavonic texts by heart with the priest. This was a lofty, mystical religion, connected with a series of beautiful thoughts and feelings, which it was not only possible to believe because one was told to, but even to love. Kitty did not learn all this from words. Madame Stahl spoke with her as with a dear child who gives one pleasure by reminding one of one's own past, and only once mentioned that love and faith alone can bring relief in all human sorrows, and that no sorrows are too trivial for Christ's compassion. Then she immediately changed the subject. But in Madame Stahl's every movement, every word, every heavenly look, as Kitty called it, and especially in the whole story of her life, which Kitty learned from Varenka, she discovered what was important and what she had not known before. But however lofty may have been Madame Stahl's character, however touching her story and however elevated and tender her words, Kitty could not help noticing some perplexing traits in her. She noticed that Madame Stahl, when inquiring about Kitty's relatives, smiled contemptuously, which did not accord with Christian kindness. And once, when Kitty met a Roman Catholic priest at the house, she observed that Madame Stahl carefully hid her face behind the lampshade and smiled in a peculiar manner. Trifling as these things were, they disturbed Kitty, and she felt doubts about Madame Stahl. But Varenka, lonely, without relatives or friends, with her sad disillusionment, wishing for nothing and regretting nothing, personified that perfection of which Kitty only allowed herself to dream. In Varenka she saw that it was only necessary to forget oneself and to love others in order to be at peace, happy, and lovely. And such a person Kitty wished to be. Having now clearly understood what was most important, Kitty was not content merely to delight in it, but immediately with her whole soul devoted herself to this newly revealed life. She formed a plan for her future life based on what Varenka told her about the work of Madame Stahl and of others whom she named. Like Madame Stahl's niece, Arlene, of whom Varenka told her a great deal, Kitty determined, wherever she lived, to seek out the unfortunate, help them as much as she could, distribute gospels, and read the gospel to the sick, to criminals, and to the dying. The idea of reading the Gospels to criminals, as Arlene did, charmed Kitty particularly. But all these were secret dreams which she did not speak of either to her mother or to Varenka. However, while waiting for the time when she could put her plans into operation on a larger scale, Kitty, imitating Varenka, here at the watering place where there were so many sick and unhappy people, easily found opportunities to apply her new rules. At first, the princess only noticed that Kitty was strongly influenced by her engouement, as she called it, for Madame Stahl, and especially for Varenka. She noticed that Kitty not only imitated Varenka's activities, but involuntarily copied her manner of walking, speaking, and blinking her eyes. But afterwards, the princess also noticed that, apart from this infatuation, a serious spiritual change was taking place in her daughter. She saw that in the evening Kitty read the Gospels in French, given her by Madame Stahl, which she had not done before, that she avoided her society acquaintances and made up to the invalids who were under Varenka's protection, and especially to the family of Petrov, a poor, sick artist. Kitty evidently prided herself on fulfilling the duties of a sister of mercy in that family. This was all very well, and the princess had nothing against it, especially as Petrov's wife was quite a well-bred woman, and the German princess, having noticed Kitty's activities, praised her, calling her a ministering angel. It would have been quite right had it not been overdone. But the princess saw that her daughter was getting out of bounds, and spoke to her about it. "Il ne faut jamais rien outre," she said to her one day. But her daughter did not reply. She only felt in her soul that one could not speak of overdoing Christianity. How was it possible to exaggerate when following the teaching which bids us turn the other cheek when we are struck and give our coat when our cloak is taken? But the princess disliked this excess, and disliked it all the more because she felt that Kitty did not wish to open her whole heart to her. And Kitty really did hide her new views and feelings from her mother. She kept them secret not from want of respect and love, but just because her mother was her mother. She would have revealed them to anyone sooner than to her. "It seems a long time since Anna Pavlovna was here," said the princess once, speaking of Mrs. Petrova. "I invited her, and she did not seem pleased."
"I did not notice anything, Mamma," said Kitty, flushing up.
"Is it long since you went to see them?" "We are all arranging to go for a drive up the mountains tomorrow," replied Kitty.
"Well, go if you like," said the princess, looking intently into her daughter's confused face and trying to guess the cause of her confusion.
That same day Varenka came to dinner, and said that Anna Pavlovna had changed her mind about going to the mountains tomorrow. The princess noticed that Kitty blushed again.
"Kitty, have you not had some unpleasantness with the Petrovs?" the princess asked when they were again alone together. "Why has she stopped sending the children here, and coming herself?"
Kitty replied that nothing had passed between them, and that she did not at all understand why Anna Pavlovna seemed dissatisfied with her.
Kitty spoke the truth. She did not know why Anna Pavlovna had changed toward her, but she guessed it.
She guessed it to be something that she could not tell her mother, and did not even say to herself. It was one of those things which one knows and yet cannot say, even to oneself. So dreadful and shameful would it be to make a mistake.
Again and again she went over in memory all the relations she had had with that family.
She remembered the naive pleasure expressed in Anna Pavlovna's round, good-natured face whenever they met, remembered their secret consultations about the patient, and their plots to draw him away from his work, which the doctor had forbidden, and to take him for walks, and the attachment to her felt by the youngest boy, who called her My Kitty and did not want to go to bed without her. How good it had all been! Then she recalled Petrov's thin, emaciated figure in his brown coat, with his long neck, his thin, curly hair, his inquiring blue eyes, which had at first seemed to her terrible, and his sickly efforts to appear vigorous and animated in her presence. She remembered her first efforts to conquer the repulsion she felt for him, as for all consumptives, and her efforts to find something to say to him. She remembered the timid look, full of emotion, with which he gazed at her, and the strange feeling of compassion and awkwardness, followed by a consciousness of her own benevolence that she had experienced.
How good it had all been!
But all that had been at first. Now, for some days past, all had suddenly been spoiled. Anna Pavlovna now met Kitty with affected amiability and constantly watched her husband and her. Could his touching pleasure when she drew near be the cause of Anna Pavlovna's coldness?
Yes, she remembered. There was something unnatural in Anna Pavlovna, quite unlike her usual kindness when the day before yesterday she said crossly,
"There, he has been waiting for you and would not drink his coffee without you, though he was growing dreadfully weak."
"Yes. And perhaps my giving him his plaid may also have been unpleasant to her. It was such a simple thing, but he took it so awkwardly and thanked me so much that I myself felt awkward. And then that portrait of me, which he did so well. And above all, look, confused and tender. Yes, yes, it is so," Kitty said to herself, quite horrified, and then, "No, it is impossible. It must not be. He is so pathetic."
Chapter 34. Quite toward the end of the season, Prince Shcherbatsky, who from Carlsbad had gone on to Baden and Kissingen to see some Russian friends and to inhale some Russian spirit, as he expressed it, returned to his family. The views of the prince and princess on life abroad were diametrically opposed. The princess found everything admirable, and in spite of her firmly established position in Russian society, tried when abroad to appear like a European lady, which she was not, being thoroughly Russian. She therefore became somewhat artificial, which made her feel uncomfortable. The prince, on the contrary, considered everything foreign detestable and life abroad oppressive, and kept to his Russian habits, purposely trying to appear more unlike a European than he really was. He returned looking thinner, with the skin on his cheeks hanging loose, but in the brightest of spirits. His spirits were still better when he saw Kitty completely recovered. The news of her friendship with Madame Stahl and Varenka, and the information the princess gave him of the change she had observed in Kitty, disturbed him and aroused in him his usual feelings of jealousy toward anything that drew his daughter away from him, and of fear lest she might escape from his influence into regions inaccessible to him. But these unpleasant rumours were soon drowned in that sea of kind-hearted cheerfulness which was always within him, and which was increased by the Carlsbad water. The day after his arrival, the prince, attired in a long overcoat and with his Russian wrinkles and his slightly puffy cheeks supported by a stiff collar, went out in the brightest of spirits to the springs with his daughter. The morning was lovely. The bright, tidy houses with their little gardens, the sight of the red-faced, red-armed, beer-saturated German housemaids, and the clear sunshine cheered the heart. But the nearer one came to the spring, the more often one met sick people, whose appearance seemed yet sadder amid these customary well-ordered conditions of German life. Kitty was no longer struck by this contrast. The bright sunshine, the gay glitter of the green trees, and the sounds of music had become for her the natural framework of all these familiar figures, and of the changes for better or for worse which she watched. But to the prince, the radiance of the June morning, the sounds of the band playing a fashionable and merry valse, and particularly the appearance of the sturdy maidservants, seemed improper and monstrous, in contrast with all those melancholy living corpses collected from all parts of Europe. In spite of the pride and the sense of renewed youth which he experienced while walking arm in arm with his favourite daughter, he felt almost awkward and ashamed of his powerful stride and his large, healthy limbs. He had almost the feeling that might be caused by appearing in company without clothes. "Introduce me. Introduce me to your new friends," he said to his daughter, pressing her arm with his elbow. "I have even taken a liking to your nasty Soden, because it has done you so much good. But it's sad, this place of yours. Very sad." "Who is that?" Kitty told him the names of the acquaintances and others whom they met. Just at the entrance to the gardens they met the blind Madame Berthe with her guide, and the prince was pleased by the tender look on the old Frenchwoman's face when she heard Kitty's voice. With French exaggeration she at once began talking to him, admiring him for having such a delightful daughter, and in Kitty's presence praised her up to the skies, calling her a treasure, a pearl, and a ministering angel. "Then she must be angel number two," the prince remarked with a smile. "She calls Mademoiselle Varenka angel number one." "Oh, Mademoiselle Varenka is a real angel, allez," said Madame Berthe. In the gallery they met Varenka herself. She was walking hurriedly toward them with an elegant little red bag in her hand. "See, Papa has come," said Kitty to her. Simply and naturally, as she did everything, Varenka made a movement between a bow and a curtsy, and immediately began talking to the prince just as she talked to everybody, easily and naturally. "Of course I know you. I've heard all about you," the prince said to her with a smile, by which Kitty saw with joy that her father liked Varenka. "Where are you hurrying so to?" "Mama is here," said she, turning to Kitty. She did not sleep all night, and the doctor advised her to go out. I am taking her her work.
So, that is Angel Number One, said the prince when Varenka had gone.
Kitty saw that he would have liked to make fun of Varenka, but was unable to do so because he liked her.
Well, let us see all your friends, he added, including Madame Stahl, if she will condescend to recognize me.
Oh, do you know her, Papa? Asked Kitty, alarmed by an ironical twinkle in the prince's eyes when he mentioned Madame Stahl.
I knew her husband and her, too, slightly, before she joined the Pietists.
What are Pietists, Papa? Asked Kitty, frightened by the fact that what she valued so highly in Madame Stahl had a name.
I don't know very well myself. I only know that she thanks God for everything, including all misfortunes, and thanks God for her husband's death. And it seems funny, for they did not get on well together.
Who is that?
What a pitiful face, he said,
noticing an invalid of medium height who sat on a bench in a brown coat and white trousers, which fell into strange folds over his emaciated legs. The man raised his straw hat above his thin, curly hair, uncovering a tall forehead with an unhealthy redness where the hat had pressed it.
It is Petrov, an artist, Kitty replied, blushing. And that is his wife, she added, indicating Anna Pavlovna, who, on their approach, went away with apparent intention, following a child who had run along the path.
Poor man! What a nice face he has, said the prince.
Why did you not go up to him? He looked as if he wished to say something to you.
Well, come back then, said Kitty, turning resolutely.
How are you today? She asked Petrov.
Petrov rose with the aid of a stick and looked timidly at the prince.
This is my daughter, said the prince. Allow me to introduce myself.
The artist bowed and smiled, exposing his strangely glistening white teeth.
We were expecting you yesterday, Princess, he said to Kitty.
He staggered as he said it, and to make it appear as if he had done this intentionally, he repeated the movement.
I meant to come, but Varenka told me that Anna Pavlovna sent word that you were not going.
Not going?
Said Petrov, flushing, and immediately beginning to cough and looking round for his wife.
Aneta! Aneta!
He said loudly, and the veins in his white neck protruded like thick cords. Anna Pavlovna drew near.
How is it you sent word to the princess that we were not going?
He said in an irritable whisper, his voice failing him.
Good morning, princess, said Anna Pavlovna with a forced smile, quite unlike her former way of greeting Kitty. I am very pleased to make your acquaintance, she went on, turning to the prince. You have long been expected, prince.
How is it you sent to tell the princess we were not going?
The painter whispered hoarsely and still more angrily, evidently irritated because his voice failed him and he could not give his words the expression he desired.
Oh, dear me, I thought we were not going, said his wife with vexation.
How so? When...
He was interrupted by a fit of coughing and made a hopeless gesture with his hand. The prince raised his hat and went away with his daughter.
Oh, oh, he sighed deeply. What poor things.
Yes, Papa, replied Kitty. And you know they have three children, no servants, and hardly any means.
He received something from the academy, she explained animatedly, trying to stifle the excitement resulting from the strange alteration in Anna Pavlovna's manner toward her.
And there's Madame Stahl, said Kitty, pointing to a bath chair on which, under a sunshade, lay something supported by pillows wrapped up in grey and pale blue. It was Madame Stahl. Behind her was a sullen-looking, robust German workman who pushed her bath chair. At her side stood a fair-haired Swedish count whom Kitty knew by name. Several patients lingered nearby, gazing at this lady as at something out of the common.
The prince approached her, and Kitty immediately noticed in his eyes that ironical spark which so disturbed her. He went up to Madame Stahl and spoke to her extremely politely and nicely in that excellent French which so very few people speak nowadays.
"I do not know whether you will remember me, but I must recall myself to you in order to thank you for your kindness to my daughter," he said, raising his hat and not putting it on again.
"Prince Alexander Shcherbatsky," said Madame Stahl, lifting toward him her heavenly eyes, in which Kitty detected displeasure. "I am very pleased. I have grown very fond of your daughter."
"Your health is still not good?"
"No, but I am accustomed to it," said Madame Stahl, and introduced the Swedish count to the prince.
"You are very little changed," said the prince. "I have not had the honour of seeing you for 10 or 11 years.
"Yes, God sends a cross and gives the strength to bear it. It often seems strange to think why this life should drag on." "On that side," she said irritably to Varenka, who was not wrapping the plaid round her feet the right way.
"To do good, probably," said the prince, whose eyes were laughing.
"That is not for us to judge," said Madame Stahl, detecting a something hardly perceptible on the prince's face. "Then you will send me that book, dear Count? Thank you very much," she added, turning to the young Swede.
"Ah!" exclaimed the prince, seeing the Moscow colonel standing nearby, and with a bow to Madame Stahl he moved away with his daughter and with the Moscow colonel who had joined them.
"That is our aristocracy, prince," remarked the colonel, wishing to appear sarcastic.
He had a pique against Madame Stahl because she did not wish to be acquainted with him.
"Always the same," answered the prince.
"Did you know her before her illness, prince? I mean, before she was laid up?"
"Yes, I knew her when she first became an invalid."
"I hear she's not been up for 10 years.
"She does not get up because her legs are too short. She has a very bad figure."
"Papa, impossible!" exclaimed Kitty.
"Evil tongues say so, my love. But your Varenka does get it," he added. "Oh, those invalid ladies!"
"Oh, no, papa," Kitty objected warmly. "Varenka adores her. And besides, she does so much good. Ask anyone you like. Everybody knows her and Arlene Stahl."
"Perhaps," he said, pressing her arm with his elbow. "But it is better to do good so that, ask whom you will, no one knows anything about it."
Kitty was silent, not because she had nothing to say, but because she did not want to reveal her secret thoughts, even to her father. Yet, strange to say, though she had made up her mind not to submit to her father's opinion and not to let him enter her sanctuary, she felt that the divine image of Madame Stahl, which she had carried in her bosom for a whole month, had irrevocably vanished, as the figure formed by a cast-off garment vanishes when one realizes how the garment is lying. There remained only a short-legged woman who was always lying down because she had a bad figure, and who tormented poor, unresisting Varenka for not tucking her plaid the right way. And by no efforts of imagination could the former Madame Stahl be recalled.
Chapter 35. The prince imparted his good spirits to his household, his friends, and even to his German landlord. On returning from the spring with Kitty, the prince, who had invited the colonel, Maria Yevgenyevna, and Varenka to come and take coffee, had a table and chairs brought out into the garden under a chestnut tree, and breakfast laid there. The landlord and the servants brightened up under his influence. They knew his generosity, and in a quarter of an hour the sick Hamburg doctor who lived upstairs was looking with envy from his window at the merry party of healthy Russians gathered under the chestnut tree.
Beneath the trembling shadow circles of the leaves, around a table covered with a white cloth and set out with coffee pot, bread, butter, cheese, and cold game, sat the princess in a cap with lilac ribbons, handing out cups of coffee and sandwiches. At the other end sat the prince, making a substantial meal and talking loudly and merrily. He spread out his purchases before him, carved caskets, spillikins, and paper knives of all kinds, of which he had bought quantities at all the different watering places, and he gave them away to everybody, including Lishkin, the maid, and the landlord, with whom he joked in his funny, broken German, assuring him that not the waters had cured Kitty, but his excellent food, especially his plum soup. The princess laughed at her husband for his Russian ways, but was livelier and brighter than she had ever been during her stay at the watering place. The colonel smiled, as he always did at the prince's jokes, but with regard to Europe, which he thought he had carefully studied, he sided with the princess. The good-natured Marya Yevgenyevna shook with laughter at everything the amusing prince said, and even Varenka, in a way new to Kitty, succumbed to the feeble but infectious laughter inspired by the prince's jokes. All this cheered Kitty up, but she could not help being troubled. She could not solve the problem unconsciously set her by her father's jocular view of her friends and of the life she had begun to love so much. To this problem was added the change in her relations with the Petrovs, which had been so clearly and unpleasantly demonstrated that morning. Everybody was merry, but Kitty could not be merry, and this troubled her still more. She felt almost as she used to feel when, as a child, she was locked up in a room for punishment and heard her sister's merry laughter. "Now, why have you bought that mass of things?" asked the princess, smiling and passing her husband a cup of coffee.
"One goes out walking, comes to a shop, and they ask one to buy something. It's Erlaucht, Excellence, Durchlaucht. Well, by the time they get to Durchlaucht, I can't resist, and 10 thalers are gone."
"That's all because you are bored," said the princess.
"Bored? Of course I am. The time hangs so heavy, my dear, that one does not know what to do with oneself."
"How can you be bored, prince? There is so much that is interesting in Germany now," said Marya Yevgenyevna.
"But I know all your interesting things. Plum soup and pea sausages. I know them. I know it all." "No, say what you please, prince. Their institutions are interesting," said the colonel. "What is there interesting about them? They're as self-satisfied as brass farthings. They've conquered everybody. Now, tell me, what am I to be pleased about? I have not conquered anybody, but here I have to take off my own boots and even put them outside the door myself. In the morning I have to get up and dress at once and go down to the dining room to drink bad tea. Is it like that at home? There, one wakes up without any hurry, gets a bit cross about something, grumbles a bit, comes well to one's senses, and thinks everything well over without hurrying."
"But time is money. Don't forget that," said the colonel.
"It all depends on what time. There are times when one would give a whole month for a shilling, and there are times when you would not give half an hour at any price. Is not that so, Kitty? Why are you so glum?"
"I'm all right."
"Where are you off to? Stay a little longer," he said, turning to Varenka.
"I must get home," said Varenka, rising and bursting into another fit of laughter. When she had recovered, she took leave and went into the house for her hat. Kitty followed her. Even Varenka seemed different now. She was not worse, but different from what Kitty previously had imagined her to be.
"Oh, dear, I have not laughed so much for a long time," said Varenka, collecting her sunshade and bag. "What a dear your papa is."
Kitty remained silent.
"When shall we meet?" asked Varenka.
"Mama was going to call on the Petrovs."
"Will you be there?"
asked Kitty, trying to sound Varenka.
"I will," answered Varenka. "They are preparing to leave, so I have promised to help them pack."
"Then I'll come too."
"No, why should you?"
"Why not? Why not? Why not?" asked Kitty with wide-open eyes,
and holding Varenka's sunshade to prevent her going.
No, wait a bit.
Tell me why not?
Oh, nothing. Only your papa has returned, and they don't feel at ease with you.
No, no, tell me why you do not wish me to be often at the Petrovs. You don't, do you?
Why?
I have not said so, replied Varenka quietly.
No, please tell me.
Shall I tell you everything? Said Varenka.
Everything, everything, said Kitty.
There is nothing special to tell, only Petrov used to want to leave sooner, but now does not want to go, said Varenka, smiling.
Well, go on,
Kitty hurried her, looking at her with a frown. Well, I don't know why, but Anna Pavlovna says he does not want to go because you are here. Of course that was tactless, but they quarrelled about you. And you know how excitable such invalids are. Kitty frowned yet more and remained silent, and only Varenka spoke, trying to soften and soothe Kitty, and foreseeing an approaching explosion of tears or words, she knew not which. So, it is better for you not to go. And, you understand, don't be hurt.
It serves me right. It serves me right, Kitty began hurriedly,
snatching Varenka's sunshade out of her hands and looking past her friend's eyes. Varenka felt like smiling at her friend's childish anger, but feared to offend her.
Why serves you right? I don't understand, she said.
It serves me right because it was all pretense, all invented and not heartfelt. What business had I with a stranger? So it comes about that I am the cause of a quarrel and have been doing what nobody asked me to do, because it is all pretense, pretense and pretense.
But what motive had you for pretending?
Said Varenka softly.
How stupid, how stupid. There was no need at all. It was all pretense,
Kitty said, opening and shutting the sunshade.
But with what object?
To appear better than others to myself and to God. To deceive everybody. No, I shall not give in to that again. Let me be bad, but at any rate not false, not a humbug.
But who is a humbug?
Asked Varenka reproachfully.
You speak as if...
But Kitty was in one of her fits of passion. She would not let Varenka finish.
Oh, I'm not talking about you, not about you at all. You are perfection. Yes, yes, you are all perfection. But how can I help it if I am bad? It would not have happened if I were not bad. So let me be what I am, but not pretend. Oh, what is Anna Pavlovna to me? Let them live as they like, and I will live as I like. I cannot be different. And it's all not the thing, not the thing.
What is not the thing? Said Varenka, quite perplexed.
It's all not the thing. I can't live except by my own heart, but you live by principles.
I have loved you quite simply, but you, I expect, only in order to save me, to teach me.
You are unjust, said Varenka.
But I'm not talking about others, only about myself.
Kitty, came her mother's voice, come here and show Papa your corals.
Kitty took from the table a little box which held the corals, and with a proud look, without having made it up with her friend, went to where her mother was.
"What's the matter? Why are you so red?" asked both her mother and father together.
"Nothing," she said. "I'll come back in a minute," and ran away.
"She's still here," thought Kitty. "What shall I say to her? Oh, dear. What have I done? What have I said? Why have I offended her? What am I to do? What shall I say to her?" thought Kitty, and stopped at the door.
Varenka, with her hat on, sat at the table examining the spring of her sunshade, which Kitty had broken. She looked up.
"Varenka, forgive me. Forgive me,"
whispered Kitty, coming close to her.
"I don't remember what I said."
"Really, I did not wish to distress you," said Varenka, with a smile. peace was made. But with her father's return, the world in which she had been living completely changed for Kitty. She did not renounce all she had learned, but realized that she had deceived herself when thinking that she could be what she wished to be. It was as if she had recovered consciousness. She felt the difficulty of remaining without hypocrisy or boastfulness on the level to which she had wished to rise. Moreover, she felt the oppressiveness of that world of sorrow, sickness, and death in which she was living. The effort she had been making to love it now seemed tormenting, and she longed to get away quickly to the fresh air, back to Russia, to Ergoshovo, where, as she knew from a letter, her sister Dolly had moved with the children. But her affection for Varenka was not weakened. When taking leave of her, Kitty tried to persuade her to come and stay with them in Russia. "I will come when you are married," said Varenka. "I shall never marry." "Well, then, I shall never come." "Then I will marry for that purpose only. Mind now, don't forget your promise," said Kitty. The doctor's prediction was justified. Kitty returned to Russia quite cured. She was not as careless and light-hearted as before, but she was at peace. Her old Moscow sorrows were no more than a memory. Part 3, Chapter 1. Sergei Ivanich Koznishev, wishing to take a rest from mental work, went to stay with his brother in the country instead of going abroad as usual. According to his views, country life was preferable to any other, and he had now come to his brother's house to enjoy it. Konstantin Levin was very pleased, especially as he no longer expected his brother Nikolai to come that summer. But in spite of his affection and respect for Koznishev, Konstantin did not feel at ease with his stepbrother in the country. To Konstantin, the country was the place where one lived, that is to say, where one rejoiced, suffered, and labored. But to Koznishev, the country was, on the one hand, a place of rest from work, and on the other, a useful antidote to depravity, an antidote to which he resorted with pleasure and with a consciousness of its utility. To Konstantin, the country seemed a good place because it was the scene of unquestionably useful labor. To Koznishev, it seemed good because one could and should do nothing there. Besides this, Koznishev's attitude toward the peasants jarred on Konstantin. Koznishev was wont to say that he knew and loved the common people. He often conversed with peasants and was able to do it well, frankly, and without affectation, deducing from every such conversation data in the peasants' favor and proofs of his own knowledge of the people. Konstantin regarded the peasants as the chief partners in a common undertaking, and despite his respect and the feeling of a blood tie, probably, as he said, sucked in with the milk of his peasant nurse, he, as partner in their common undertaking, though often filled with admiration for the strength, meekness, and justice of these people, was very often, when the business required other qualities, exasperated with them for their carelessness, untidiness, drunkenness, and untruthfulness. Had Konstantin been asked whether he liked the peasants, he would not have known what to answer. He both liked and disliked them, just as he liked and disliked all human beings. With his natural, kind heart, he of course liked human beings more than he disliked them, and naturally the peasants were included. But he could not like or dislike the people as if they were something apart, because he not only lived among them, his interests closely bound up with theirs, but he considered himself one of the people and could not find in himself any special qualities or defects which placed him in contrast with them. Moreover, though he had lived in very close relations with the peasants as their master, mediator, and above all as their adviser, the peasants trusted him and would often come 30 miles to consult him, he had no definite opinion concerning them. Had he been asked whether he knew the people, he would have been just as much at a loss for a reply as he was for a reply to the question whether he liked them. To say that he knew the peasants was tantamount to saying that he knew human beings. He continually observed and learnt to know all sorts of human beings, among them human beings of the peasant class, whom he considered interesting, constantly discovering in them new traits and altering his opinions accordingly. Koznishev, on the other hand, just as he praised country life as a contrast to the life he disliked, liked the peasants as a contrast to the class he disliked, and regarded them as a contrast to humanity in general. His methodical mind had formed definite views on the life of the people, founded partly on that life itself, but chiefly on its contrast. He never altered his opinions about the people, nor his sympathetic attitude toward them. In the disputes which took place between the brothers when discussing the peasants, Koznishev was always victorious, just because he had definite views about them, their character, attributes, and tastes, while Konstantin had no definite and fixed views and was often guilty of self-contradiction when arguing on that subject. Koznishev thought his younger brother a splendid fellow, with his heart in the right place, but with a mind which, though rather quick, was swayed by the impression of the moment and was therefore full of contradictions. With an elder brother's condescension, he sometimes explained to him the meaning of things, but could find no pleasure in discussion because he could gain too easy a victory. Konstantin considered his brother to be a man of great intellect, noble in the highest sense of the word, and gifted with the power of working for the general welfare. But the older he grew and the more intimately he came to know his brother, the oftener the thought occurred to him that the power of working for the general welfare, a power of which he felt himself entirely destitute, was not a virtue, but rather a lack of something. Not a lack of kindly honesty and noble desires and tastes, but a lack of the power of living, of what is called heart, the aspiration which makes a man choose one out of all the innumerable paths of life that present themselves and desire that alone. The better he knew his brother, the more he noticed that Koznishev and many other social workers were not led to this love for the common good by their hearts, but because they had reasoned out in their minds that it was a good thing to do that kind of work and took to it accordingly. What further strengthened this conviction was noticing that his brother did not take the question of the general welfare or of the immortality of the soul any more to heart than a game of chess. Another thing which made Konstantin Levin feel his brother's presence inconvenient was that in the country, especially during the summer, while Levin was always busy with the farm and the long summer days were too short for doing all that had to be done, Koznishev was resting. But even though he was resting from mental labours and was not writing, he was so used to mental activity that he liked expressing his thoughts in an elegant, concise style and liked having a listener. His most usual and natural listener was his brother, and therefore, despite their friendly relations, Konstantin felt uncomfortable at leaving him alone. Koznishev loved to lie basking in the sunshine, talking lazily. "You can't imagine what a pleasure this complete laziness is to me. Not a thought in my brain. You might send a ball rolling through it." But it wearied Konstantin to sit listening to him, particularly because he knew that during his absence the manure was being carted into the field, and it was impossible to guess where they would throw it if he were not there to see. The ploughshares, too, would not be screwed up properly or taken out, and then he would be told that these ploughs were a silly invention. "How can they be compared to our old Russian plough?" and so on. "Haven't you walked about enough in this heat?" said Koznishev.
"No, I must just look in at the counting-house for a moment," answered Levin, and off he ran to the fields.
Chapter 2. At the beginning of June, Levin's old nurse and housekeeper, Agafya Mikhailovna, happened to slip as she was carrying to the cellar a jar of mushrooms which she had just pickled, and sprained her wrist. A talkative young medical man who had only just qualified and been appointed doctor for the Zemstvo district arrived, examined the hand, said it was not sprained, and enjoyed a talk with the celebrated Sergei Ivanovich Koznishev. He told him all the gossip of the district to show off his enlightened views and complained of the unsatisfactory conditions prevailing there. Koznishev listened attentively, asked questions, and enlivened by the presence of a new listener, became quite chatty, made some pointed and weighty remarks respectfully appreciated by the young doctor, and reached that state of animation his brother so well knew, which generally followed a brilliant and lively conversation. After the doctor's departure, Koznishev felt inclined to go to the river with his fishing rod. He was fond of angling, and seemed proud of being able to like such a stupid occupation. Konstantin, who was obliged to go to the cornfields and meadows, offered to give his brother a lift in his trap. It was just the time of year, the turning point of summer, when the result of that year's harvest becomes assured, when the autumn sowings have to be considered, and when the hay harvest is close at hand, when the grey-green rye waves its formed but as yet not swollen ears lightly in the wind, when the green oats, with irregular clumps of yellow grass interspersed, stand unevenly on late-sown fields, when the early buckwheat spreads out and hides the ground, when the fallow land, trodden as hard as a stone by the cattle, is half-ploughed, with here and there long strips omitted as too hard for the plough, when the smell of dried heaps of manure in the fields mingles with the honeyed perfume of the grasses, and waiting for the scythe, the lowland meadows lie smooth as a lake by the river's banks, showing here and there black heaps of weeded sorrel stalks. It was the time of that short pause before the labour, yearly renewed, of getting in the harvest, which always demands all the peasant's strength for its accomplishment. The promise of the harvest was splendid, the weather clear and hot, and the short night dewy. The brothers had to pass through the forest on their way to the meadows. Koznishev was all the while filled with admiration for the beauty of the thickly leaved forest, and kept pointing out to his brother the old lime trees, looking so dark on the shady side, covered with creamy buds all ready to burst into blossom, or the new shoots, sparkling like emeralds on the trees. Konstantin Levin did not like talking or hearing about the beauty of nature. Words seemed to detract from the beauty of what he was looking at. He assented to what his brother said, but could not help thinking of other things. When they emerged from the forest, his attention was arrested at the sight of a fallow field and a hillock, here and there yellow with grass or broken up and cut into squares, in some parts speckled with heaps of manure or even ploughed. A string of carts was moving over the field. Levin counted the carts and was pleased to see that sufficient manure was being brought. At the sight of the meadows, his thoughts turned to the hay harvest. The thought of the hay harvest always touched him to the quick. When they reached the meadow, Levin stopped. At the roots of the thick grass, the morning dew still lingered, and Koznishev, afraid of wetting his feet, asked his brother to drive him across the meadow to the willow clump near which perch could be caught. Though Konstantin was loath to crush his grass, he drove across the meadow. The tall grass twined softly about the wheels and the horse's legs, leaving seeds on the wet spokes and hubs. Koznishev sat down by the willows, while Levin led away his horse, and having tethered it, stepped into the immense grey-green sea of grass, so dense that the wind could not ruffle it. In the meadow, which was flooded every spring, the silky grass, now scattering seeds, reached almost to his waist. When Konstantin Levin had passed right across the meadow and reached the road, he met an old man with a swollen eye carrying a swarm of bees in a skep.
"Have you found it, Famich?" he asked. "Found it indeed, Konstantin Dmitrich. I only hope not to lose my own. This is the second time a swarm has got away, and it's only thanks to those lads there that I've got this one back. They were ploughing for you and unharnessed a horse and galloped after it. Well, Famich, what do you think? Shall we begin mowing or wait a little?" "Oh, well, our custom is to wait till St. Peter's Day, but you always mow earlier." "Why not, God willing? The grass is fine. There'll be more room for the cattle." "And what do you think of the weather?"
"That's God's business. Perhaps the weather will keep fine, too."
Levin went back to his brother. Though he had caught nothing, Koznishev did not feel bored and seemed in the best of spirits. Lievin saw that he had been roused by his conversation with the doctor and wanted to have a talk. Lievin, on the contrary, was impatient to get home in order to give orders about hiring the mowers on the morrow and to decide about the hay harvest, which greatly occupied his mind.
"Well, let's go," said he.
"Where's the hurry? Let's sit here a little. How wet you are. Though nothing bites, it's pleasant. Hunting and similar sports are good because they bring one in touch with nature. How lovely this steel-coloured water is," said he. "And these grassy banks always remind me of that riddle. You know, the grass says to the water, 'We will shake, we will shake.'"
"I don't know that riddle," replied Lievin, in a dull tone.
Chapter 3
"Do you know, I've been thinking about you," said Koznishev. "From what the doctor told me, and he's by no means a stupid young fellow, the things going on in your district are simply disgraceful. I've already told you, and I say it again, it is not right to stop away from the Zemstvo meetings, and in general to take no part in its activities. If all the better sort stand aside, of course, heaven only knows what will happen. We expend money for salaries, but there are no schools, no medical assistants, no midwives, no chemists, no anything."
"You know I have tried," Lievin replied slowly and reluctantly, "but I can't.
So what am I to do?" "Why can't you? I confess I don't understand. I can't admit it to be indifference or inaptitude.
Is it possible that it is mere laziness?"
"Neither the one nor the other, nor the last. I have tried and seen that I can do nothing," said Lievin. He did not pay much attention to what his brother was saying. Peering into the distance across the river, he made out something black in the cornfield and could not see whether it was only a horse or the steward on horseback.
"Why can you do nothing? You have made an attempt, and because, according to your judgment, it was a failure, you gave it up. Fancy having so little ambition."
"Ambition," reiterated Lievin, stung by his brother's words.
"I do not understand it. If at college they had told me that others understood the integral calculus and I did not, that would have been a case for ambition. But in these matters, the first requisite is a conviction that one has the necessary ability, and above all, that it is all very important."
"Well, and is it not very important?" said Koznishev, stirred by the perception that his occupations were regarded as unimportant, and especially by his brother's evident inattention to what he was saying.
"They don't appear important to me. Do what you will, they don't grip me," replied Lievin, having made out that what he saw was the steward, who was probably dismissing the peasants from their ploughing too soon, for they were turning the ploughs over.
"Is it possible they have finished ploughing?" thought he.
"Come now, after all," continued the elder brother with a frown on his handsome, intelligent face, "there are limits to everything. It is all very well to be a crank, to be sincere, and dislike hypocrisy. I know that very well. But what you are saying has either no meaning at all or a very bad meaning. How can you consider it unimportant that the people whom you love, as you maintain—" "I never maintained it," thought Lievin, "are dying without help. Ignorant midwives murder the babies, and the people remain steeped in ignorance at the mercy of every village clerk, while you have in your power the means of helping them, and yet you are not helping because you do not consider it important." And Koznishev confronted his brother with this dilemma. Either you are so undeveloped that you don't see all that you might do, or you don't want to sacrifice your peace of mind or your vanity, I don't know which, in order to do it. Constantine felt that there was nothing for him but to submit, or else to own to a lack of love for the common cause, and he felt wounded and grieved. "Both the one and the other," said he resolutely. "I can't see how it is to be done."
"What? Don't see how medical help can be given by distributing the money in a proper way?"
"Well, it seems impossible to me. To give medical help over the whole 3,000 square miles of our district, with our deep snow, impassable when it begins melting, our snow drifts,
and the pressure of work at harvest time is impossible. Besides, I have no faith in medicine generally. Oh, come now, that is unjust. I could cite thousands of cases to you. And how about schools?
Schools? What for?
What do you mean? Is it possible to doubt the utility of education? If it is good for you, why not for everybody? Constantine felt himself morally cornered, and in consequence became excited and involuntarily betrayed the chief cause of his indifference to social questions. All this may be very good, but why should I trouble about medical centres which I should never use, or schools to which I should never send my children, and to which the peasants would not wish to send theirs either, and to which I am not fully convinced they ought to send them, said he. This unexpected view of the question took Koznishev by surprise, but he immediately formed a new plan of attack. He remained silent a while, lifted his rod and threw the line again, and then turned to his brother with a smile. Now, let's see. There is need of a medical centre, after all. Did we not send for the district doctor, for Agafya Mikhailovna? But I think her hand will remain crooked all the same. Well, that's very questionable. And then a peasant who can read and write is more useful to you, and worth more. Oh, no. Ask anyone you like, said Constantine decidedly. A peasant who can read and write is far worse as a labourer. They can't mend the roads, and when they build a bridge, they steal. However, all that is not to the point, said Koznishev, frowning. He did not like to be contradicted, especially when he was met with arguments that incessantly shifted their ground, introducing new considerations without sequence, so that it was difficult to know which of them to answer first. Wait a bit. Do you admit that education is a good thing for the people?
I do,
replied Levin unguardedly, and at once realized that he had not said what he really thought. He felt that, since he admitted this much, it would be proved to him that he was talking meaningless twaddle. How it would be proved to him he did not know, but he knew that it certainly would be proved, logically, and waited for that proof. The proof turned out to be far simpler than Constantine anticipated. If you admit it to be good, said Koznishev, then as an honest man you cannot help loving and sympathizing with such movements and wishing to work for them.
But I am not yet prepared to say that such work is desirable, returned Levin.
What? Why, you said just now, I mean I consider it neither desirable nor possible. You can't tell without having tried it.
Well, let's grant it is so, said Levin, though he did not grant it at all. Still, I don't see why I should be bothered with it.
What do you mean?
No. Oh, since we have started on the topic, perhaps you'd better explain it to me from a philosophical point of view, said Levin.
I don't see what philosophy has to do with it, replied Koznishev, in a tone that made it seem, at least Levin thought so, that he did not consider his brother had a right to argue on philosophical questions. This irritated Levin.
This is what it has to do with it, he said, getting heated. I believe that in any case the motive power of all our actions is our personal happiness. At present, I, a nobleman, see nothing in our Zemstvo that could conduce to my welfare. The roads are not better and cannot be made better, and my horses do manage to pull me over the bad ones. I don't require doctors and medical centres. I don't need the magistrate. I never apply to him and never will. I not only do not require schools, but they would even do me harm, as I have already told you. To me, the Zemstvo means nothing but a tax of 2 kopecks per desiatina, my having to go to the town, sharing a bed with bugs, and listening to all sorts of nonsense and nastiness, and my personal interests do not prompt me to do it.
Come, smilingly interrupted Koznishev. It was not our personal interest which induced us to work for the emancipation of the serfs, and yet we did it.
No, no, Constantine interrupted, growing more and more heated. The emancipation of the serfs was quite a different matter. There was a personal interest in that. We wanted to throw off a yoke that was oppressing us all good men.
But to be a member of the council to discuss how many scavengers are required and how the drains should be laid in a town in which I am not living, to be on the jury and try a peasant who's stolen a horse, to sit for 6 hours on end listening to all sorts of rubbish jabbered by the council and prosecutor, and to the president asking our idiot Alyoshka, "Prisoner at the bar, do you plead guilty to the indictment of having stolen a horse?"
Konstantin Levin was being carried away and was personating the judge and the idiot Alyoshka. It seemed to him that all this was relevant to the case in point. But Koznishev shrugged his shoulders.
"Well, what do you want to prove by that?"
"I only want to prove that I will always stand up with all my power for the rights which touch me and my personal interests. When they searched us students and gendarmes read our letters, I was ready to defend with all my power my right to education and liberty. I understand conscription, which touches the fate of my children, of my brothers and myself, and I am ready to discuss what concerns me. But how to dispose of 40,000 rubles of Zemstvo money, or how to try the idiot Alyoshka, I neither understand nor can take part in."
Konstantin Levin spoke as if the dam of his flood of words had been broken. Koznishev smiled.
"And tomorrow you may be going to law. Would you rather be tried in the old criminal court?"
"I won't go to law. I'm not going to cut anybody's throat, so I shall never be in need of that sort of thing. All those Zemstvo institutions of ours," he said, again jumping off to a subject that had no bearing on the case in point, "are like those little birches that are cut down for decorations at Whitsuntide, and we Russians stick them up to imitate the woods that have grown up naturally in Western Europe. I cannot water these birches or believe in them from my soul."
Koznishev only shrugged his shoulders to express his wonder at this sudden introduction of little birches into their discussion, though he had at once grasped his brother's meaning.
"Wait a moment. One can't reason that way, you know," he remarked.
But Konstantin, wishing to justify the failing of which he was aware in himself, his indifference to the general welfare, continued,
"I think that no activity can endure if it is not based on personal interest. That is the common and philosophical truth," said he, emphasizing the word philosophical, as if he wanted to show that he might talk about philosophy as much as anyone else.
Koznishev smiled again.
"He too has some philosophy or other to serve his inclinations," he thought.
"You'd better leave philosophy alone," said he. "The principal task of philosophy has always, in all ages, been to find the necessary connection existing between personal and general interests. But that is not the point. I need only correct your illustration to get at the point. The birches are not stuck in. Some of them are planted, and others are sown and have to be tended carefully. Only those peoples have a future. Only those peoples can be called historic that have a sense of what is important and great in their institutions and value them." And to prove the inaccuracy of Levin's views, Koznishev carried the conversation into the realm of philosophy and history, which was beyond Konstantin's reach. "As to your not liking it, pardon me, but that only comes of our Russian laziness and seigneurial habits, and I am sure that in your case it is a temporary error and will pass." Konstantin was silent. He felt himself beaten at every point, yet was sure that his brother had not understood what he had been trying to say, only he did not know why this was so, whether it was because he could not express himself clearly, or because his brother either could not or did not wish to understand him.